from the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin, welcome to The Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor in pediatric surgery here in Madison. I'm new here, and with this podcast, I'm exploring the ideas, inventions, and innovations of our department, plus meeting a lot of really interesting people. I'm excited for you to join me. Our guest today is Dr. James Cole, Jr. He's an assistant professor of surgery at the University of Wisconsin, and he's the trauma medical director at Swedish American Hospital, which is a UW Health regional hospital in Rockford, Illinois. Dr. Cole's a retired Navy medical officer with 24 years of military service, and during that time, he cared for troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. During his last assignment, Dr. Cole served as chief medical officer in Southwest Afghanistan, responsible for all areas of healthcare and an eight-nation coalition force. Most recently, he's also the author of Trauma, My Life as an Emergency Surgeon from St. Martin's Press, which is available wherever books are sold. Dr. Cole, welcome to The Surgery Set.
Thank you for having me, Jonathan.
It's really great to have you here. Thanks for driving up from Rockford and coming back to the mothership here. How long have you been in Rockford?
I joined the group in May of this past year.
And you came straight out of the armed services?
No. So I spent my first 10 years on active duty in the military. I left active duty in late September of 2000, thinking it was a peaceful world. It probably needed me more in the civilian world than the military. But less than 1 year later, 9/11 happened. And of course, I was upset at myself for having left. And so I rejoined and I entered the reserve forces and I deployed to the combat zone three times as a reservist. And in between those deployments, I worked at a level one trauma center in Downers Grove, Illinois, and in Oak Lawn in the South Side.
Wow. Well, first of all, thank you for your service.
Thank you for your support.
And your talk that you give, that's the reason you're up here today and it's available on our website, sort of goes through a lot of the history of the role that surgery and surgeons have played in wartime and a lot of the developments that have come out of war in terms of surgical advancement, medical advancement. But what I thought was most striking about that was the way that it was grounded in your personal experience. I mean, obviously, you give a very different talk about the effect of war on surgery and surgery on war than somebody who hasn't been in the middle of it.
Well, you know, I was grateful for my military experience. I enjoyed a lot of my military experience, but I also love trauma surgery and, you know, medicine in general. So the two things naturally go together. And so that's why I enjoy that particular topic so much.
Yeah, what I thought was really great about your talk is that it really gives an extraordinary historical perspective on what we do. I think it's so easy and, you know, just coming to work every day and you like log into the computer and you fill out your notes and you go to the OR and you do this operation that you learned how to do, you know, in my case, not very long ago. But to remember that like that goes in a direct line back to Hippocrates, you know, that we really are this sort of ancient profession that has been incrementally improving on itself over time. And one of the things I thought was really interesting about your talk is you actually point out that not only are we like incrementally improving over time from the time of Hippocrates, but intermittently we've made discoveries that have then been sort of lost to history and then been rediscovered.
Yes, I totally agree. The tourniquet, for example, so many things between World War I and World War II, for whatever reason, you know, shock management lessons were largely forgotten.
Right. Even this principles of vascular control, which you talk about, was it Galen was involved in controlling vascular injuries in gladiators,
right,
to maintain gladiator prowess and
right,
the
with
income
clamps
stream.
And ligatures. And then some guy later on decides a hot seared iron on the end of a limb is a more reasonable option. Of course, they did away with that
right,
100 years.
Yeah. And then, you know, a thousand years later, we're back to sewing up the limb. Really extraordinary stuff. I think the other thing that really came home to me was if you were to draw a chart of sort of the amount of surgical innovation, you know, it's obviously kind of increases exponentially as our most recent conflicts have come across. You talk a lot about how the research process has infiltrated the military surgical theater.
There's an overwhelming amount of research that has taken place during the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq compared to any time in history. You know, the data that was gathered during the Vietnam War really was pretty crude. You know, some surgeons would, they do a case and then they'd scribble something down on a piece of paper, put it in their pocket, and then maybe in 3 or 4 days they'd put it all together into something and turn that into a paper. That's really crude research compared to what is being done now and the vast amounts of data that's gathered, analyzed, and actually put into action, the results of, you know, the data analysis, it's incredible compared to what's happened in the past.
So what's the day-to-day impact of that in the way that you were treating patients in the field?
So it could be weekly, or perhaps every several weeks, or maybe a month at times. We would get a notice that would be sent to us on one of our multiple different communications devices that would say, hey, from the Institute of Surgical Research or from the Surgeon General of the Army or the Navy or whatever, you're going to change the way that you do this particular type of care. Change the way you do, let's say, traumatic brain injury care, or change the way that you give blood transfusions or something of that nature. Those are our clinical practice guidelines that were changed. They were modified as a result of the data that was gathered real time on the battlefield and by physicians and surgeons and nurses. So we would put data into these databases while the patients were still with us, and they may give us changes or directions as to how we're going to change our practice as a result of that very data that we input, let's say, a few months back.
Yeah, so it's just constantly iterative care.
Yeah. We'd have weekly conferences, as a matter of fact, with the director and his team at the Institute of Surgical Research in Fort Sam Houston, and we were in Afghanistan. So there was this huge time zone difference, and you know, for some people it would be very early morning, and for some people it would be very late, but we would have real-time discussion of what they're finding, but they haven't yet quite concluded. So we were really receiving the most cutting-edge analysis of the data. As a matter of fact, we could treat patients, and then they would go home, and let's say, you know, 5 days later, they're at Brooke Army Medical Center, and we could ask, hey, how's my guy doing? Yeah. That I did that laparotomy on. So it's so different now compared to even how it was at the very beginning of the war. My first tour in Afghanistan, which was in 2004, it was so different in 2014.
Yeah, that's just extraordinary. I mean, if you could imagine the civilian medical apparatus responding that quickly to changes. I mean, we're in an era where it takes 15 years to sort of recognize that beta blockers might be helpful.
Right.
And to have that sort of rapid feedback based on the data that you're providing. And you weren't in a palace of a hospital,
no.
Right? You weren't in downtown Kabul.
No, I was in a tent or a Quonset hut or a shack, but I was never in something that I would call a real hospital.
But you were operating.
I was doing a lot of operation, a lot of surgery. You know, you talk about changing our paradigms in the civilian community compared to changing how we practice in the military. Well, one of the differences, don't forget, we have a chain of command that applies all across the board. You know, there's no competition between this particular group and this university and that, whatever.
Right.
I mean, you all work for the same four-star general when it all boils down. And if he passes something down the line, you follow those orders.
Right.
And that's how things work in the military.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's not like you say, well, in my training, we did a little differently. I don't really want to change. You know, I'll be dragged kicking and screaming into this new thing that seems very evidence-based. Like, you actually have the rule of law.
Well, we add flavor to how we practice based on our institutional training, our practice, and our clinical skill set. But the standard operating procedures followed are very well established.
Yeah. I sort of took some notes as your talk was going on. And I mean, what I noticed was you started talking about the history of trauma, and that was armies and gladiators, and then moving sort of up into the Napoleonic Wars, where we hear about the first implementation of ambulances, and then Civil War is the implementation of credentialing. It's just amazing to think of, you know, there was a time when this didn't exist, and then it came into being because of one guy and decided we should credential surgeons on through World War I and World War II. And my list of things that get invented and associated with each war kind of got longer and longer and longer and longer. And, you know, up until the Global War on Terror, where we're talking about damage control surgery, decompressive craniotomies, the return of the tourniquet, critical air transports, resuscitation ratios, factor 7, TXA, on-site blood banking, what you call the vampire program, advances in amputation technology, and just a wild increase in the amount of research that's being done. It's clear that we're on an amazing trajectory for surgical discovery coming out of these conflicts. And do you have any sense sort of what's next? I mean, you've seen the future presumably out there on the field.
Well, I'm not one of the guys in the know, you know, at the ISR, Army Institute of Surgical Research, but I do know that they're working on these modular suits for people on the battlefield to real-time monitor heart rates, pulse, blood pressure, et cetera, so that they can determine if a person is sick or needs to come out of action, or, oh boy, this guy clearly, you know, his heart rate's now 130, his pressure's, you know, 30. I think he's been shot or something. I think that's a long way off. There are a lot of technologies like that that people are working on, but I think that we'll get our biggest bang for the buck, if you will, if we teach more people how to do life-saving procedures and push them a little bit far forward. You know, like, there's no reason why every intern and intern-level trainee and, frankly, nurse, paramedic can't do most of the things that we do in the trauma room, which is like intubate and cricothyroidotomy and needle decompression and, you know, start lines and things like that. I think that's where we're going to get our biggest bang for the buck, by pushing more junior people forward with advanced skill sets in trauma resuscitation.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, now, you know, TXA has become a pre-hospital therapy. Lines and intubations are becoming pre-hospital therapy. Blood transfusion, yes, during transport. I mean, I guess what we're seeing in sort of the pre-hospital world here in the U.S. is trickling out of the military, as it has for thousands of years.
Yeah, you know, another thing, the Brits were really good at directing traffic from the battlefield. Mm. So they would send out these Chinook helicopters, these 47s, and there would be a physician who was usually an emergency medicine physician and a critical care or an ER nurse, a couple PAs that were not only really skilled in combat, but also skilled as physician's assistants. And they would have a number of medics and other people with other types of skill sets on this helicopter. And they would go to the combat and they would literally pick up the casualty within, you know, 10, 15 minutes of being shot or hit.
Wow.
And they would put them on this helicopter, this armor-plated dual rotor helicopter, and they would make an assessment. And based on the physician's and the nurse's assessment, they would say, we are not going to your damage control facility that's 14 minutes away. We're going to the facility that's 42 minutes away because they have a neurosurgeon. We assess this patient needs a decompressive craniectomy. And, you know, because we get a lot of patients at our level 3 and level 2 trauma centers that end up going to the level 1 trauma centers. That ultimately likely could translate, you know, in our civilian communities to better direction of traffic from the scene. You know, right now it's pretty much done by the paramedics or protocols and or med control, but who knows? In the future, maybe it'll be done in a different way and you get the people to the most appropriate facility first without need for secondary transfer.
Right, without sort of that reflexive, just what's the closest hospital.
Right.
What's it been like, you know, coming out of Afghanistan to Swedish American in Rockford, which I can only assume is a substantially different facility?
I loved my service in the military. I mean, let's face it, there are things I hated too, but, you know, I really enjoyed serving, but I'm so glad that I'm retired. It was just time. You know, I was the old man. And when you get to a certain rank, you realize that nobody else wants to be around you because you're too senior in rank. So it was time to get out in that respect for me anyway. But I am so happy at Good Samaritan. It's just it's a nice facility to practice. We get great support here from the UW, and I couldn't be happier, honestly. I know that sounds silly, like I'm just telling you that because this is an interview, but no, truthfully, I'm very happy with where I am in life.
Yeah. No reason to do the same thing forever.
Right.
What's your practice there? What do you?
So I'm the trauma medical director, but we see far less trauma than I saw as a level 1 trauma surgeon and, of course, in the combat zone. But I do mostly general surgery, both acute care general surgery, elective general surgery. So like a standard surgery practice, you see patients in the clinic, you operate on them electively, you take call, you operate on people in the middle of the day, the middle of the night, you take care of them for days or weeks, and you see them in the clinic thereafter.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, thank you again for coming up and giving your really remarkable summary of surgical history, and particularly focusing on the way that our servicemen and women have been helped by the advancement of medicine and the work that all the surgeons in the military have done to advance care that's really helping us every day in the public across the world. And I think everyone should take a look at your talk. It's at surgery.wisc.edu. And before you go, tell me a little bit more about the book.
Okay. So Trauma, My Life as an Emergency Surgeon was never intended to be a book. Okay. The truth of the matter is we all have experiences that I think haunt us or play recurrently through our mind that maybe at times we wish we could just let go. Well, in the course of my training to become a surgeon, there were some traumas that were pretty brutal, pretty devastating, that affected me forever in one way or another, including after I was already a surgeon and then going to combat and so forth and so on. So anyway, one day I decided to just journal these stories that were pretty out of the box, you know, crazy, wild trauma experiences. And I just wrote down everything that came to my mind, just free flow wrote. And after a while, I said, hey, I've got enough stories here that if I put them in chronological order and add a few other stories, I guess I could have a book. And that's what I did. And for some reason, St. Martin's Press liked it and they picked it up. And next thing you know, it's a book.
Remarkable. When did it come out?
November 2012, I believe, is when it came out.
Wow. And it's telling the stories of Sarah.
Yeah, it tells the most dramatic trauma stories that I've dealt with on a personal level. And there's some commentary in there as well with respect to a variety of the very common problems trauma surgeons deal with, i.e. in their patient population. You know, a lot of our patients are criminals, they're mentally ill, they are homeless, they're in gangs, they're substance abusers, et cetera, and so forth. And the dealings, you know, the pain and suffering that we experience in dealing with these collateral problems that are often associated with the practice of trauma surgery.
Sounds remarkable. I will be buying a copy today.
So. Thanks. Great.
Dr. Cole, thank you so much for joining us on the Surgery Set. It's been really a pleasure to have you up here and to hear your whole recitation of the history of surgery and the military and the role that surgeons have played in warfighting, but also the role, how it's changed how we practice medicine here in civilian life. A really fascinating talk, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Jonathan.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Surgery Set. Join us next time when we'll hear from Dr. Jocelyn Burke, a UW General Surgery Chief Resident, who takes us through the do's and don'ts of complex hernia repair. The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Rebecca Wazileski and myself. It was audio engineered by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to Grand Rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health Video Library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And of course, you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Wisc Surgery, as well as me at J.E. Kohler. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing, and especially let us know if there are topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, and we hope you check back soon. On Wisconsin.